Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald & Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the D.C. metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we are talking government contract fraud with one of my favorite guests over the last couple of years, Sarah Chu, who is an associate at Joseph Greenwald & Lake. Sarah works in the QITAM practice, representing whistleblowers nationwide in sealed investigations and unsealed litigation under the Federal and State False Claims Act and other applicable laws that prohibit fraud, waste, and abuse against the government. Cases involving false claims, kickbacks prohibited under the anti-kickback statute and Stark Law, false billing, off-label marketing, and government contracting. That is a mouthful, Sarah Chu. Welcome aboard.
Good morning. Good morning, David. I'm back. Thanks
you're
for having
back.
Me.
Well, you know, you're our first to you're first to be on three times, so we're going to send you like a little prize or maybe a Starbucks gift card or something along those lines. Something that you can celebrate with. We're happy to have you.
I don't need a prize. I don't need a reward. I love doing these things. I'm so glad to be back. Like I said, this is the third episode being on here, and It's great to be back. And you're right. It is a mouthful talking about government.
Yes. Not only is it a mouthful, but I don't know very much about it. So let's start at the beginning and tell people, and there'll be people listening from all areas, right? And presumably some folks who work for the government or are affiliated with other entities that work for the government. Right. So what is it exactly? What is government contract fraud?
So the definition of government contract fraud, I would say, is any dishonest scheme by which a contractor or a subcontractor working with a federal or state government knowingly induces the government to pay money that it should not have paid under a contract for any goods and services. And so before that, just to sort of give a little bit of intro, right, I want folks listening to know that the universe of False Claims Act cases, in other words, the types of cases that potential whistleblowers can file on behalf of the government, is pretty expansive. And David, as you recall, in our first discussion, we talked about healthcare fraud. Then in our second episode, we talked about COVID-19 fraud, also a very hot topic right now. But there's much more to this than just Medicare fraud or pandemic fraud. And another category to really think about is fraud in government contracting. And it's also known as procurement fraud. And, you know, federal and state government agencies purchase so much goods and services ranging from weapon systems, computer consulting, uniforms, furniture, IT consulting. It's under a variety of procurement and government contracting rules and systems. And so any fraud that's committed by those who sell goods, provide services to the federal and state government agencies under various different industries, which I will cover in our episode today, it could be government fraud, and that can be shown, demonstrated through various different schemes and structures.
All right, so when you talk about procurement, what do you mean exactly? What's being procured by whom and from whom?
Very good question. Typical common scheme is where a contractor, a government contractor, is working with a government agency to sell a particular good or sell a particular service to the government. And so a typical common scheme is where a contractor, they may falsify information on a contract proposal submitted to the government when they procure whatever goods, whatever services that the government is looking for. During that process, the government awards the contract to the contractor, and then they agree to provide certain goods and services, but they never plan to do so. And never planning to do so, then they bill for expenses not incurred. They bill for work that was never performed. And the government has to, you know, this is all at the government's expense, right? The government is looking for a contractor that would do a certain type of job for them. They are looking for, you know, the contractor is procuring or the government is procuring certain goods and services to the government, and they realize that the government has relied on a contractor that never intended to do any of these things. And so, you know, let's just step back a little. I envision a contractor, a government contractor, who has a hunch that something is off in their workplace, right? They're working for a contracting company that is working public infrastructure project for government agencies.
Like a bridge or a road or airport.
Without getting too into the weeds, you know, you're working for a company that provides construction services for a public infrastructure project. And your boss, and you realize that your boss never had the intention of ever delivering those construction services, maybe never even had the qualifications to do so, but made all sorts of false representations to secure the government contract. So they list that they have X amount of equipment. They list that they have X amount of people working under this project. They list that they plan to provide construction by X date, will be done by X date under, you know, X amount of money. And you realize that your boss and whoever you may be working for, you know, none of which they plan to do so and maybe didn't have the capability to perform, but they falsely represented all of these things into the contract and they secured the contract with the government.
Sarah, let me ask you a question.
And maybe this is a little peeved.
No. I have a question that I think might struck me as you're talking, which is the person who's work. I mean, we all say the government, right? It's just this big, giant, blank cloud, whatever we want to call it out there. But isn't there somebody who looks at these proposals or looks at these contracts? Why are these folks who are looking to steal, because that's what they're doing, right? I mean, they're stealing. Why is it that it's so easy to get a proposal like that through whatever channels need to be gotten through in order to get awarded the deal, the contract from the government?
So the answer to that would be twofold. You know, there are contracting officers on behalf of the government that takes a look at these contracts. And you're right, they should be looking for, I mean, the reality is the rules and regulations that govern these government contracts, they are consistent, but I think they are flexible, right? And so the contracting officer would check off a number of things to make sure that the contract is kosher, right? But there are also various nuances, maybe some gray areas, where the contractor sort of could take advantage of certain provisions in the contract to steal from the government. And so the government, you know, doesn't necessarily rely on the contracting officer to make sure that they're doing the right thing. They're relying on the contracting officer to make sure that the contract looks good enough so that they're looking for so that they get the best goods and the best services out of a particular contracting company. Now, I do believe that the government relies on a contractor too much, right, for certain certifications and representations that are made in the contract to decide whether they want to secure the contract. I mean, it's a big decision. And so the contracting officer may take a look to see that the contract is kosher, but, you know, you really have to look at the language provided in the contract. You know, what did the contractor agree to provide? Did they expressly agree to provide a certain good or a product or a service? Did they agree to abide by certain rules and regulations? And none of the language is so expansive that it covers everything, right? It could just simply say, I agree to abide by, you know, federal statute to make sure that the good is good enough for the government. And so I think that there is definitely room there's room for, you know, flexibility, but there's also, it's constant. The rules and regulations are consistent, but they're flexible, and they're too flexible for a lot of these subcontractors and prime contractors to steal from the government.
I mean, and I may be taking you off the track a little bit, which I kind of promised not to do, but I always break my promises.
So let's just
dumb this down a little bit, right? So I'm a contracting officer for the Department of Transportation, pick whatever. And we're building, let's do the simplest part. We're building a new leg of a train rail from Chicago to Detroit. And I've been a contracting officer for 25 years. That's what I do. So I'm assuming that the government puts out a request for bids, whatever that's called, and that there's however many bids that come in that I have to review to decide or make a recommendation as to which one of these contractors is going to put the rail line down or dig the trench in order to get the rail line laid or whatever the case may be.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a general rule in life, right? If something looks too good to be true, it probably is, right? So I got these 10 proposals. How do these thieves, because that's what they are, how do they get past me? How do they get past me to even to get to where I know what you want to talk about, which is the whistleblowing part of it and the act and so forth. But it's like the birth, right? The genesis of the problem. How am I letting these dudes get past me?
I mean, that's a question that I always have too for my whistleblowers when they come here. How did this happen? How did it get to a point where the contracting officers kind of blow through the contracts and just let this happen? I mean, there's so many answers to those questions. And I think it's a very case by case, right? I mean, there are a ton of contracts out there. There are a ton of government contracting firms out there that are looking to contract with the government. I mean, these government contracting, you know, even transportation contracts, these could be like 10 to 15 year contracts, right? Mm-hmm. So these are huge sums of money that we're talking about for long durations. When you've got, like you said, when you've got 10 bids coming in, you also, you know, the contracting officer would be thinking a lot of different things, a lot of different factors going to make a decision to pick the right contractor. It could be budgetary issues, right? There could be, if something looks too expensive, they can't go with that. If something looks too, I think it can get past the government because prime contractors have flexibility to outsource, you know, they also contract with subcontractors as well. And contracting officers don't go to the extent of checking to make sure that those subcontractors that the prime contractors are contracting with, I know this is a lot of different people under the contract, but the contracting officer is not obligated under any rule and regulation but they don't go to the extent. They rely on the prime contractor to make sure that they get the right subcontractor to do the work. And so just getting into the next subject is that many government prime contractors actually that contract with subcontractors with outside companies to work on a particular transportation project, more often than not, those subcontractors and prime contractors are working together to defraud the government, right? And so subcontractors are not directly billing whatever invoice or payment or what an invoice or purchase order or task order that they would, they're not directly billing it to the government or the contracting officer, they're billing it to the prime contractor. And so the contracting officer and the government puts a lot of responsibility on those prime contractors to make sure that those invoices are not false, that they're accurate, that they're reflecting the actual work, the project status, the actual work that they've done, the actual tools and you know, whatever they need to fund the government project. A lot is on that prime contractor to make sure that everything is accurate and represented in a way that they agreed to represent initially in the contract. And so I personally think that there's room for development there. There needs to be some improvement, right? Maybe the contracting officer, we need to hire people that could understand what goes on between the prime contractor and the subcontractor. It's hard to believe that there's all this gray area, but I also have those questions as well when the whistleblower comes to me and say, well, wasn't there a contracting officer that was checking off all the boxes when the procurement contract was being secured? And there are. And we try to look for those hot documents too. We try to look for an email between the contracting officer and the prime contractor saying, this is fine, this isn't fine. I mean, like anything like that is helpful as well in bringing, and I keep bringing it back to a whistleblower case, but those are good questions. How does it happen? And it happens because there's a lot of flexibility between the relationship between a prime contractor and a contracting officer who's supposed to make sure that the contract is kosher, but they're not obligated to check every single thing that a subcontractor bills for.
Okay.
And like I said, I did say that the prime contractor and the subcontractor often works in conspiracy, but that they conspire together. But oftentimes, prime contractors themselves may not have knowledge of the fact that subcontractors are planning to defraud the government. And so we kind of spin it as subcontractors cause the false billing, cause the prime contractor to falsely bill the government for those services not rendered.
Okay. So there, I mean, what you're talking about there in terms of the theft is falsifying invoices, basically, right? Providing the government with fake bills that gets paid for work that didn't get done or products that didn't get provided.
Right, right. And you know, what I always tell potential clients that come to me is, A, if you have the initial government contract, great. We always want to look at the, you know, oftentimes these cases, especially more so than healthcare QTAM cases, government contracting cases are very contract heavy, document specific. So if you have the government initial government contract, great. If you don't, then I look at supporting documents, right? There could be, like you said, discrepancies between billing records and invoices, purchase orders, and what's actually being billed to the government. Any vague or incomplete information, inaccuracies that they might spot on invoices or task orders. I mean, all of these are, quote, smoking guns that the government often looks for.
And in terms of other misrepresentations or other ways in which these cretins look to steal our tax dollars, what about the status of a project, for example, misrepresenting, you know, that we're here as opposed to there, kind of a thing?
Right. So contractors, you know, after they secure the contract, you know, now the contract is put into full effect. The contractor is supposed to be providing transportation services or construction, any goods for government, Department of Transportation, for a government agency. And the next question that you should ask yourself if you're planning to bring a whistleblower case is that, so now that the contractor wins the contract, you know, how do we spot the fraud? Is it a done deal? Absolutely not. The project, like I said, could last for 10 to 15 years. It's the reason why that government contracting firms want to sit on this cushy 10 to 15 government deal to make sure that they get paid out on a monthly or quarterly basis. And so it's so important that they update their project status to make sure that they continue receiving the government funds. And so just going back to what the contractors periodically submit to the government is so important. And it could be the prime contractor submitting false invoices, which refer to invoices for goods or services that were never rendered, goods that were never bought. It could be cheaper goods that they buy, but then they mark it off as an expensive good. And so those are often inflated invoices, duplicate invoices, right? They could be a number of different. Those are also fraudulent if issued knowingly with the intent to defraud. I remember earlier on, there was a case that I had, and this one didn't go anywhere because the client didn't have too much stuff, but it was an infrastructure project, I think. And one of the guys had been billing, one of the prime contractors had been billing the government for various different goods, but they had been bought in different Home Depots or what have you. It was bought from different places, but they were all the same type of supplies. And he had bought so many supplies from different stores, but it didn't match up because what did you do with all these supplies? And so the government was paying off these invoices for duplicate supplies that he had strategically bought from different I don't think it was a Home Depot, but from different places that he had purchased. And so this happens, right? And if the contracting officer, I mean, at that point, when you are submitting an invoice or if you're submitting a task order, purchase order to the government midway through the project, that's not the job of a contracting officer, right? It's now the contract is in full effect. Often it's just harder and harder for the government to catch these things because they kind of just let it fly through.
Okay. So in that circumstance, if you're a potential whistleblower, you work for somebody who's putting you out on the job site or whatever the case may be, you know, what are the red flags? What are you looking for in that circumstance?
Yeah. Very good question. I touched up on this a little bit, but the supporting documents, I think, is really, really key for these types of cases. Oftentimes, if you preserved a copy of the initial RFP, the request for proposal, a bid, the government contract, those are helpful. Oftentimes, the solicitations are publicly available, so I like to pull that information. But if you have it, I want to look at the contract language. And if you're in a position to preserve those information, I mean, that's great. And I'm always looking for purchase orders, invoices, task orders, anything that shows that there's a discrepancy between what was actually billed to the government versus what you actually purchased and what you actually did. Anything that we can support our narrative with, I mean, those are very, very useful. And oftentimes, the government specifically asks for, like, if we just have a billing number, or if we have a purchase order or task order, or any information that can lead to that. You know, my goal is always to steer the government in the right direction where they can find these things in the defendant company's files. And so if you don't have it, that's fine. If you have it, that's great. I want to take a look at all of them. But those are some of the things. Those are some of the red flags that you should really be mindful of before you bring these types of cases.
And tell me a little bit about the involvement or connection with cybersecurity in these types of cases.
My favorite topic. You know, False Claims Act whistleblower lawsuits are not just government contracts, but they're also cybersecurity. They're related to cybersecurity issues. And contractors, I think, really need to understand from a whistleblower perspective that there are so much risk, FCA risk, associated with cybersecurity noncompliance. And if they don't, they get hit with these whistleblower lawsuits. In recent years, the government and QTAM plaintiffs have been utilizing the FCA to pursue non-compliance with cybersecurity regulations cases. And some of those efforts have gained a lot of traction. And I'm still learning through them, but they are very interesting. In July of 2019, there was a very big FCA settlement. I think it was like 8.2 or 8.5 million settlement. And it was a company that agreed to pay that because it violated the FCA by selling video surveillance systems to state and federal agencies that contained blatant software flaws. And it enabled those agencies to be hacked by, cybersecurity hackers. And so that was a big case that came out. It was the first time a cybersecurity-related QTAM case resulted in a huge settlement. That was in 2019. And I think it's going to be, I'm sure a lot of cases are under seal right now, but there have been there's going to be an increase, right, in a lot of those FCA cases that relates to cybersecurity. And just to sort of go back to what that looks like.
Let me ask you a question. So toggling back to that case that you just discussed, the corporate defendant that provided the security goods, the cameras, does the allegation have to be that they knew or should have known of the flaw, or is it a lesser, more of a negligent standard?
It's a lesser, more of a negligent standard. A lot of these cybersecurity noncompliance are likely to be framed as fraudulent inducement causes of action, or they could be brought under this implied certification theory. And so they had to have known, right? But at the same time, both categories make them liable. The first would be if they're, absolutely negligent, reckless disregard, that's also a thing, and the former one would be, there has to be, typically in the contract, there are provisions where it says, it could be a simple line where it says, I abide by so-and-so rule. I certify that I'm compliant with the applicable cybersecurity rules and regulations. And just by that understanding, you have to know, right? You have to have the knowledge that the contractor is out of compliance with the statutory or regulatory or contractor requirement. At least one person in that company has to have known. And of course, they're going to argue that they didn't know, right? They didn't know that a specific statute was, was being violated. But that sort of thing is very material to the government's decision to pay a claim. And so for that corporate company, I can't recall, but I think they did try to argue that they didn't know that this was happening. They didn't know that they were violating a certain cybersecurity law. But, this is implied certification. If you are going to be a reseller of a video surveillance company, you for sure, if your government customer is asking for these things, there's a potential liability for failure to comply. And you arguing that you didn't know that it was a failure for compliance, it's a hard battle. And
okay.
So, hence the $8 million settlement.
Yeah, I guess all of this legislation, all these laws, arise from the fact that companies, entities, individuals are trying to steal from the government with a great deal of propensity. I suppose is the right word, right? So,
yeah.
So whistleblowers play an important part, it seems to me, in terms of protecting the public, at least indirectly, if not directly. If you are a whistleblower, right, or a potential one, what should you do? What do you do? I'm working. Take the person who was working for that company with the security cameras, right?
Yeah.
The surveillance equipment. What do I do? In some ways, you don't want to. You probably feel like you're a spy of some sort.
Right.
Taking photographs of documents and that sort of thing. But what should I do if I think this is going on? The folks that I'm working for are stealing from the United States of America. What do I do?
Yeah, good question. The reseller, the employee that worked for that reselling company, you know, he discovered the security weakness early on while he was working for the company. He filed a lawsuit in 2011 and the settlement didn't come out until 2019. So that was, you know, an 8-year investigation. Oh, that's a long time for a whistleblower to keep things under wrap. And you're right. As a whistleblower, you run the risk of being viewed as a spy, as someone who is always going to blow the whistle on these types of things. But, you know, I always tell my clients they bring a lot to the table, and myself and the government, for sure, all the U.S. attorneys that I do work with on a daily basis, they really appreciate these whistleblowers coming forward. So there's pros and cons to this. I would advise folks, you know, to talk to an attorney sooner rather than later. It would be more beneficial for you to find out what legal options are out there under the False Claims Act at a juncture where your information may be the most timeliest to pursue a case. You may be on your way out of the company. You may be being discriminated or retaliated. You may have left already. You know, these government contracts, the purchase orders, the task orders that we were talking about, they're probably, if you have them, we want to get them. And it's harder and harder for you to possess those if you have already left the company. And so I always tell them, come to us quickly. These are timely cases. Initial consultations are typically free, no obligation. And I keep things, you know, it's completely confidential. And so you want to make sure, you want to know what legal options are out there at a juncture where you're able to possess those documents. Because when you leave the company, it's just harder and harder to possess those.
Well, if I'm one of those people, Sarah Chu, I'm calling you. And if there's any others out there, how would they reach you?
I think by email, schu@jgllaw.com would be the best way. I'm always here. And so we assess each case very thoroughly before we take on the case. And I think as a starting point, a client's testimony is very, very valuable for building credibility for these types of cases. And so even if there's not a lot of documentary evidence on hand, I want to vet the client. I want to see what you have. I want to make sure that I can sort of develop a discovery plan where we can steer the government in the right direction and make sure we catch these bad guys, like we've been saying.
All right. Well, Sarah Chu, you never disappoint. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been great to have you. Thanks to everyone out there for listening in, and we hope that you join us for our next episode.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, David.
All right, Sarah. And I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.